Good morning. Welcome to the roundtable for this Friday, the 30th of August. The last broadcast day for this month, another one down the drain, and here we go. So we'll be ready to get through the Labor Day weekend, and then we'll be into September and fall, election time.
School. I'm excited for fall. I mean, I have a lot of projects that are just waiting in the wayside until people come back.
Yeah, so. I know. That is true. That is true. And right. I have about 17 emails out that I hope on Tuesday or Wednesday of next week I actually get answers to. That
just
would be
resend
very nice.
Them all on Monday.
I will.
Monday evening.
Yeah.
Or, yeah. So they're in
just
the
want this at the top of your inbox.
Yeah.
Right. Exactly. We'll do all of that. In the meantime, we have a lot to discuss this morning. Of course, we will talk about the interview that took place last night on CNN with both Kamala Harris and Tim Walz with Dana Bash from CNN. And this is the first joint interview, but the first big interview that Kamala Harris has given to the press prior to since being taking over the front runner Democratic status, and then obviously being the nominee. So we will we'll talk about that in just a moment. Let me remind you that you can be a part of the program by joining us, panel@wamc.org, panel@wamc.org, and we would love to hear from you. Let me introduce our group this morning. We've got a good one. Former EPA regional administrator, visiting professor at Bennington College, and president of, actually just professor at Bennington College, and president of Beyond Plastics, Judith Enck. Hello, Judith. How are you?
Good morning. I'm great. I have long maintained that September is the best month of summer. Embrace that.
Especially in these parts, right? I mean, it's just, it's a beautiful time of year. There's so much going on, and I agree with you. It's an especially gorgeous time. We welcome, as well, the CEO of the Business Council of New York State, Heather Mulligan, is here. Hello, Heather. How are you?
I'm good. Good morning. Yeah, I am with Judith on the weather thing. I love September, and the leaves are starting to change, and I actually walked into my garden this morning and went, holy cow, all the tomatoes turned red sometime over the last week. So I have some, I have to deal with them. I either have to freeze them or make something with them this weekend. But I have an extra day for that. So
I was driving down a back road in Washington County, which I realize they're mostly back roads. But there was a big trailer on the back, a big farm trailer, and it was just covered in tomatoes. And I mean, there had to have been 500 tomatoes. And there's just a sign that says, "Help us take whatever you need."
Yeah, yeah. Yeah. I mean, I went out and went, oh no, because it's going to be, it's a lot. I mean, it's not 500 pounds, but I've got a good 50 pounds of tomatoes to deal with. So
it's a lot out there. Well, that's very good. And again, wonderful times of the year. Ulster County Controller and the former president and CEO of the Community Foundation of the Hudson Valley, March Gallagher joins us. Hi, March. How are you?
Good. Good morning. Yeah, the tomatoes in my garden are crying. They're being overtaken by squash. Butternut squash is growing out of control. And it's a great time of year for that. It's also a great time of year to listen to Joe's interview from yesterday. Joe, I have to give you a shout out.
Oh,
really enjoyed hearing Shad White and his book on the Mississippi swindle. You know, true to an auditor's heart.
I was
right?
gonna say, you know, that's auditor porn. Yeah,
it really is. But I love the way that he talks about, you know, one of the things he talks about in that interview is how to talk about what he's doing and how to resist people calling for him to be silent, which is an experience that I often have. And he talks about, you know, I am protecting taxpayer dollars. So anyway, it was a great interview. If people haven't heard it, they should go back and listen.
I have little or no complaints about that book or that interview, other than I don't know. I don't think the story is over. You know, I think there's going to be much more happening there. I think there are loose ends And you write another book, I guess.
It's the tip of the iceberg. I never thought, like, ooh, maybe these audits could turn into a book.
Well, and that book is like that is like a page turner. I mean, that is because there's so much every day that was being unveiled
But it's the biggest uncovered. It's the biggest fraud in Mississippi history, and it involved, you know, at the end of the day, you know, touched people like Brett Favre. And, you know, I think without being the biggest swindle, it wouldn't be such news. But it came from a tip. So, you know, shout out to anybody who's listening, who's a tipster or has a thought on something that's not right.
The interview can be heard. Thank you for the nice plug. You can hear the interview in its entirety by going to wamc.org/roundtable. It broadcast yesterday. The man's name is Shad White, and the name of the book is Mississippi Swindle. All right, let's go to the big story. Of course, it was the interview that took place last night on CNN, the cable news network out of Atlanta, Georgia. Although The interview itself took place in Savannah, Georgia. And so this was hyped for a couple of reasons. One is because it was in the days leading up to the Republican National Convention and then post-convention, when is Kamala Harris going to give a sit-down interview? A lot of things have been said that she has said about being on the campaign trail, and yet both the media as well as a lot of Republicans and those on the right complaining that there was no real access to the nominee for president on the Democratic side. So this was the first interview. Then it was decided that she would do the interview along with her running mate, Governor Tim Walz of Minnesota, to put it in the words. Many people were complaining about that, to put it in the words of Sarah Huckabee Sanders, the governor of Arkansas. See, someone has to babysit her or she wouldn't be able to get through the interview. Well, the interview went off. Dana Bash was the host, and They did what I was hoping they would do, which is run the interview in its entirety. It was not edited. It was there were parts of it that were, in other words, that they would go to commercial and come back. But the full interview was aired. At least that is what they are saying. And I don't think a lot of questions. I think any real big surprises in that, but it was a steady interview, and certainly looking at a lot of the issues that had come up. Two of the big ones are a change in positions that have taken place, especially since 2019 when she ran. And then the position she took as vice president, and that took up a lot of time. And then also for Tim Walz, there were the questions about his military service and some of the claims that were made that turned out not to be fully accurate, which were explained. And those are all the a lot of what was happening with the interview. And the other thing is that this morning, many people are saying she did not still did not offer many specific proposals, which I will use as my starting question for the group, which is, I don't... Who does that? Like, I don't know. You know, we're not real good in this country of reading the fine print. We just sort of sign our name at the bottom and say, sure, we sign our life away. So to look at this and say, you know, we don't have these proposals, I just don't know how that doesn't seem that necessarily would have been the forum in which you do that in.
I mean, I did hear a couple of proposals in there, you know, the $6,000 tax child tax credit, the $25,000, you know, first time home buyer credit. But I agree with you, Joe. I think things have changed. I think when you look at the Obama run, it was very full of policy. There was a lot of policy documentation backing that up in his first term. And we don't have that so much anymore. But we're in a TikTok generation right now, and I don't know that people can absorb it. And the competition on the other side hasn't also released, you know, any substantive policy. So I think it would be, as much as I was last time on this show calling for more policy, especially on the economic side from Harris, I almost think it could be a mistake because it just leaves you open to attack from the other side, who hasn't really given strong policy except for a few, you know, hints on a couple of items. But this was kind of a snooze fest. I agree with Trump. He said it was boring. It didn't cause excitement. I think, you know, for my team, the Democrats, right, the most we get out of it is we didn't lose anybody last night. And it was kind of a steady state at best. That's kind of my takeaway. Heather just gave me a look, so she may have a different opinion.
I do.
We won anybody over with that, but maybe we didn't lose anyone.
I actually think she did very well. I'll qualify it by saying she totally whiffed on the first question. What are you going to do on your first day? I mean, that's a softball. You need to have an appealing, you know, focus group tested answer that everyone's going to go, yeah. But I mean, she like talked for 5 minutes and had to be asked the question again and talked around it and around it and around it. And finally, it was like something about helping the middle class. I mean, it was really not very specific. And I thought that was a huge missed opportunity. I do think the very, very big victory, and I should unwind a little bit and say, I thought it was a very big mistake for her to do this with the VP candidate. I think she should have done it on her own. I think she is a very serious person. I think that came through. And, you know, she's not... She in the past has been guilty of answering things in somewhat of a flip manner, which I'm also guilty of sometimes, and it gets you in trouble with the press a little bit. But she's very serious and very thoughtful, and tries to answer questions in a way that aren't impulsive, which is a huge contrast to her opponent, right? So I think what she did was she solidified her, I think, very serious credentials with independents, which is where she needs to gain ground. You know, if you are, and she probably did lose some on the Democratic side with her comments on fracking, right? So, but they have really not anywhere to go, right? And so this is all, you have to look at it through the lens of where does she need to pick up steam and where is she safe? And she's fairly safe on the D side, because anyone who is progressive or somewhat liberal is not looking at Trump as the, I'm going to save the environment, right? But she needed to gain ground and credibility with independents because a lot of people don't really know her. And I think she came across as with gravitas. And I thought that was very, very important. And I thought she made news saying that she would consider having a Republican in her cabinet. I mean, that again, that is I'm a moderate. I am, you know, I need to hear other voices. And that is, in my mind, a breath of fresh air. And I thought, you know, on those points, she did quite well. I thought having him there and having questions, you know, just a few questions for him, that didn't need to be there.
It's like the potted palm effect. I mean, look, we have that with interviews here where you say, we're going to bring along our assistant director of development, and you're like, oh, okay,
yeah, great,
and you know, you, and then the interview is all for one person, and then you're like, so what are you going to do?
Yeah,
you
know, I want to include you in the
right,
conversation.
Exactly.
You know?
And I don't I don't mean that. First of all, that is not a slam to Dana Bash, who I think did an amazing job. Nor is it a slam even. Like, I understand why you do it. I just. What I would have done is you do, and this is how these interviews have been done in the past, you do a half hour with one, you do a half hour with the other, and then you do a half hour with them together.
Yeah, but I mean, this is the first real sit-down, get-to-know-you interview That is not a debate. That is not a gotcha. It's like, talk to us about what you're going to do. And she missed on the first question. She brought, you know, someone to stand next to her, which she didn't need to do. I think she's quite competent of doing this on her own. And so I thought that was a mistake. And I just have to say, Dana Bash, I have one huge criticism. Why ask that question about, you know, he said that you're not, you know, you're not really black, or you just became black. I mean, why would you even ask that question? Is she supposed to explain herself? I thought it was just unnecessary, and it was sort of like red meat. And I'm glad she didn't answer it.
I think VP Harris did well not really taking that on. But I also think Dana Bash would have been bashed for not opening the door to that race and gender question.
Yeah, I think you would have been criticized. Although, I mean, I agree with you, Heather, except that it is – I'm fascinated of how you – like, we all had trouble unpacking that. I'm interested in the mental gymnastics she had to do to unpack that. And if she were willing to offer that, it would have been interesting. But she wasn't. So.
But the question, you don't ask the question like, someone said this nasty thing about you, please defend yourself. You say, tell us a little bit about your background. I mean, that's you can get out what you want to get out without like sort of smacking her in the face with something like that. And, you know, she probably knew the question was coming. She probably decided to answer it that way. Maybe, I don't know. But
were the questions known in advance?
No. Well, they shouldn't be. But.
No, they weren't from the reporting. And I mean, although I don't think there was a question there that any good political operative wouldn't have been able to know was coming down the pike. Judith,
right.
Thanks.
She didn't, Dana Bash didn't cover any new ground. You know, I think Harris was ready for the questions. I mean, I agree with a lot of what Heather and others have said. The most important thing is that this was normal. Like, there was no histrionics. There was no name calling. You know, questions were asked. Answers were given. She looked presidential. And I think that really came out on her response that she would appoint a Republican to her cabinet. And you're sitting there thinking, okay, she's in the Situation Room, not Wolf Blitzer's, but the real Situation Room. And she has to make a decision on an important issue, and you want to hear all the voices. And so I think she should repeat that line, that she's open, not only open, but wants to have Republican or Republicans in the cabinet. You know, she makes the decision, but you want the benefit of hearing everything. I thought it was very interesting how loyal she was to Biden. She didn't distance herself from him and his record. I agree. Tim Walz really didn't need to be there. I felt kind of bad for him. Like, it was awkward. They hardly asked him any questions. And then when they did, it was, oh, you and your wife had IUI rather than IVF. You know, it's a fertility treatment. Come on. Do we really need to play gotcha on the type of fertility treatment this family had? That was like just.
He just looked
awful.
Like at times he just, I mean, they were in a diner. It just seemed like he wanted to go over and get a muffin.
Yeah.
Yeah. And it would be really great to just have her and just have him. But if there's time, Joe, I do want to address the response to the fracking question.
Well, yes, I want to spend quite a bit of time on that, actually, because I think it was a major part. I mean, it became a major part of the discussion yesterday for a couple of reasons. One, the issue of fracking, but also, of course, of the distinction being made between comments that were made during the 2019 campaign and statements that were made as part of running with Joe Biden in 2020 as the candidate for vice president.
I don't understand why people are not allowed to change their viewpoint. You know, I mean, If you go back when Bill Clinton was president, I think he was not supportive of same-sex marriage. If you asked him today, he would say yes. And people would be, you know, they wouldn't say, well, but you used to say this, so you must forever be beholden to that position. I don't know why we do, like, there's things that happen in between. A lot has happened since 2019, including a global pandemic. There are things on, you know, on border security. She said, well, I stand by my values, and then says, well, but I also prosecuted people for crossing the border. There's an easy answer. Yeah, we did sort of try and decriminalize it. It was a disaster, so we need to rethink that and fix, actually, you know, do a comprehensive fix. There's ways of saying these things that will allow for people to actually have their opinions evolve. And I think that it's just wrong to say you should forever hold the same opinion. Now, I'm not saying that, Judith, with respect to fracking necessarily. Mm-hmm. I'm just saying that globally, I always have this reaction like, oh, well, you used to believe this. You know, are you lying now or were you lying? And I'm like, no, your opinions can change and they should. I mean, people should be educated by what they learn in the interim. So I don't.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. However, on fracking, the climate crisis has gotten worse since 2020. So I thought her answer was so inadequate. Let me start by saying, of course, she is, you know, 1,000% better than Donald Trump and Robert F. Kennedy on climate change issues and fossil fuel issues. But I thought her response was so inadequate, just that, you know, we can grow a clean energy economy without banning fracking. That simply is not the case. The climate crisis has gotten worse. And what I'm worried about is because Iowa is an early primary state, we have federal policies promoting corn ethanol, which is not a good policy from a health and environmental perspective. I worry that because Pennsylvania is a swing state, you're going to have Democrats kissing the ring of the fracking industry because they don't want to lose votes in Pennsylvania. The problem within the Democratic Party is if you're serious about climate change, and I think many are, you have to support policies that phase out fossil fuels, plain and simple. You can't just say we're putting IRA money into solar and wind and geothermal and then canceling it out by having expanded fracking, more drilling, more pipelines. You know, I don't think she necessarily wants to brag about this, but during the Biden administration, there's been more drilling of fossil fuels and more exports of fossil fuels than any other country in the world. That's the answer when Trump says, drill, baby, drill. They are. So I don't know. I think, you know, there was just a report in the journal Nature, which, of course, I read the journal Nature, but the 2023 Canadian forest fires released about 640 million metric tons of carbon, according to NASA. That's comparable to annual fossil fuel emissions of a large industrialized nation. The fires were driven by the fact that the Canadian forests were drier and the climate was warmer than it ever was in decades. We are in this really dangerous loop of, we're building some renewables, but our reliance on fossil fuels are giving us things like really intense wildfires and flooding and heat death. And she's free, obviously, to change her mind, but there's no environmental logic associated with saying in 2020 I opposed fracking, but now I'm supporting it, because the climate crisis has just gotten worse. And I really hope that she will change her mind again after November, talk to scientists, talk to health experts, and realize that she had it right the first time.
All right, so we have to take a break. When we come back, we'll continue our conversation. We have a bunch more to discuss. We welcome you, panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. We will continue with our group right after this. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion this morning. We have Judith Eng, Heather Mulligan, not Heather, no, Heather
okay,
Mulligan,
whatever.
And March Gallagher. I just thought, I mean, gives me a chance to just say one cool thing that I thought. I thought it was really interesting when Kamala called Dana Bash Dana, and then so quickly corrected herself. Here's a woman who has had her name maligned for the last 6 years, and just being very conscious that she got the name right. I have to sometimes do the mental thing with Dana. Okay, all right, because it's.
You got to say it in your head in advance.
That's right. Dana is often Dana.
Right.
Not in this case. So I thought that was interesting. Let's go.
Well, a grateful nation would like her to change her name to Dana so we don't have to struggle with it.
She can have whatever name she wants.
People in the media change their names all the time.
Yeah. J.D. Vance changed his name several times.
Hey, I've changed my name a whole bunch of times. My last name. But
I changed my last name once. Yeah.
Well,
this has now become a support group.
Yes, indeed.
Can I say something about flip-flopping, John,
Before
we go on? This came up in John Kerry's campaign, right? He was criticized for flip-flopping on a position. And I agree with Heather. People need to be able to take in new information and change their minds. The challenge here is that in the soundbite world that we live in, you don't really have a time to explain why you've changed your mind or the depth of what it means. And I just want to note, I didn't hear her say that she supports fracking. That's not the word she used. I heard her say she does not support the ban on fracking.
She said we can grow a clean energy economy without banning fracking.
She did, and I thought that those two things are not diametrically opposed, and I didn't understand the connection between them at all. I think that's a cop out to her actual position, which is probably a lot more nuanced, right? It doesn't have to be one for the other. They're not opposite, and I think she didn't have time to talk about winding fracking down, right?
Because March, it's not about nuance. It's about Pennsylvania voters.
That's exactly what I was going to say. I mean,
she changed her position on something that is so important. I agree with both you and Heather saying candidates evolve and you get new information. I mean, God bless Joe Biden for going out early on same-sex marriage. Here, if you're looking at scientific data, fracking is bad for groundwater. It's bad for the climate crisis. It is illogical to say that I wanted a ban on fracking 4 years ago, but now it's okay because the climate crisis has just gotten worse. And I also think as Democrats, we have to, and I'm not saying we're all Democrats and not all the listeners are Democrats, and I'm a nominal Democrat, but when candidates make such a profound shift, it's just not responsible to let it slide. And I think, you know, look, I'm obviously still going to enthusiastically not just vote for Harris, but actively support her. But this was a mistake, and she's running for president. This one should not be so hard.
But you got to win. And mm-hmm. if you're looking at the state of Pennsylvania, and it's a huge state, Dana Bash said this in the prelude to the question, which was, it's safe to say that you can't win this if you don't win Pennsylvania. There are other paths, but I think generally she's right on that. So if this indeed is what needs to be said at the moment, is it important for that to be said?
But there maybe would have been a better way to say it.
Along those lines, Joe, if you want to win North Carolina, maybe we should change our position on same-sex marriage. If you want to win in Georgia, maybe we need to ease up on voter rights. It is a slippery slope, and it's not happening in isolation. By the way, a lot of voters are concerned about fracking in Pennsylvania. And the problem is it's been so politically one-sided. The governor who really promoted fracking in Pennsylvania was a Democrat, Ed Rendell. After he left his position as governor, who did he go work for? Fracking companies. So, you know, the pandering to swing states only gets you so far. I agree you have to win. I'm not at all convinced that she's going to tally up more votes in Pennsylvania because she has switched her position on fracking.
So I don't think it's just Pennsylvania. That's my personal view. I listened to a really good analysis on, and I think it was a Politico reporter, but I honestly, it could have been one of the other outlets, who was talking about an analysis of the independents, because independents are becoming growing, they're of growing importance in each election cycle. And in the swing states, you know, where you have very polarized, we have a polarized electorate all over. When they talk to independents, what they want, they don't care what party the person is. What they want is someone who is competent and someone who isn't spending all of their time pandering to one side or the other, leaning hard left or leaning hard right, or bashing the other party. And you know, the overall desire of a huge part of the independent electorate is, can we please just stop this back and forth, the yo-yo, you know, anything they say is wrong because they said it, and let's talk about what do we need to govern. And I thought she accomplished that. And I know this is a fraught thing for me to say, but if I was going to develop her policy position on fracking, I think that there's a difference between a ban and a plan to phase out fossil fuels. A ban is, you know, potentially quite expensive versus a phase out. And this is a global issue. It's not Pennsylvania specific issue. I get it. Every little bit helps. But having a nuanced position, a more nuanced position than we're going to turn off the lights today, I think was something that people wanted to hear.
This just wasn't the forum for a nuanced position. That's exactly what I was saying, that you are stuck with this language
right.
in a short soundbite, and you don't have a chance to say, you know, we have the ability to build an energy economy that doesn't rely on fracking while it's an important resource right now and we need to move away from it. And she couldn't really say that.
But it wasn't really the issue. I mean, to me, the question wasn't about fracking. The question was about flip-flopping and changing your positions.
Right.
Fracking was the word to put into the space, but it could have been anything else. It was an example that was given.
And a way to address it was this weird dichotomy that I just think doesn't make sense, you know, saying that, you know, we can have a thriving clean energy economy without banning fracking. Those two things are not opposite to me.
Well, she also said that she was proud to cast the tie-breaking vote that allowed for more fracking. I think she's leaned into it pretty hard. My concern is hopefully she wins. And when she wins, the fracking industry will be at her doorstep and holding her to what she has been saying most recently. And the last thing we need, if we are serious about reducing greenhouse gas emissions and protecting people's drinking water sources, the last thing we need is more fracking.
Where is Josh Shapiro on this?
I am pretty certain he was strong as Attorney General. He brought lawsuits to protect people's drinking water in Dimmock, Pennsylvania, which has been devastated by chemicals from fracking and drinking water. And then when he became governor, I wouldn't say he flip-flopped, but his concern about fracking has been diminished, and he is really not doing anything to slow it in his state. Look, I understand, like, a lot of money is brought into communities when outside workers come in and some people get royalties on their properties, but thank God we don't have this in New York, and it is really having a very negative effect in many communities in Pennsylvania.
One more thing on this, and then I really do want to move on just to talk about other things, because we have so much to talk about this morning. But my understanding, and Judith, you can certainly correct me if I'm wrong on this, but since she's come into the race, and since there has been the Harris and Shapiro meetings and events, the numbers have gone up substantially for her in Pennsylvania. Now, it could be however many issues that, that go into that. However, this was a big one, and the needle is being moved.
But I think that's more because Joe Biden is not the candidate, and we have an energized constituency that really wants to support her and not support Trump. And again, you know, Trump, it will be a disaster on the environment. But I don't think her numbers are up in Pennsylvania because she changed her position on fracking.
I thought it was interesting. Fox News this morning was saying the honeymoon has come to an end, the honeymoon period. And I do wonder, are we at the end of the or at the former peak of the, you know, post-convention bounce for Harris? It'll be interesting to see how this plays out. They also called the interview dishonest and train wreckalicious. Really, just really very
Add
interesting
that to the
reporting.
Merriam-Webster dictionary.
I think we all in the last month or two have seen train wrecks.
And that was not it.
It did not appear to be the train wreck.
But if you're not watching the interview and you're just reading the headlines or you're just listening to a talking head, you can come away with a very different perspective. You know, it means that there are voters who are not seeing complete information if they didn't watch the interview themselves.
And well, the next chapter is the debate.
Right.
If indeed Trump shows up, mic on, mic off, whatever. I mean, my gut tells me that the Harris trajectory, the Walz trajectory, is just going to keep modestly getting better. They are very sustainably building support. They're swimming in campaign contributions. They have more volunteers that they know what to do with. And the most important thing is for Trump to keep talking and the media cover what he is saying. Because, you know, people want to return to normalcy. And you talk to anyone, left, right, center left, center right, virtually everyone says they're just tired of the fighting and the dysfunction. They want government to work for them for whatever reason, whether it's to get a fracking drilling permit or get your Social Security check on time. And if people want stability and normalcy in their government, how do you vote for Trump? It's just going to be more bedlam and chaos. And I think now the spotlight is on the mainstream media to cover Trump just as comprehensively as they covered Biden's decline and Harris right now. You know, it would be good for CNN to somehow convince Trump to sit down for an interview the way Harris and Walz sat down for an interview. I would love to see CNN interview Trump and J.D. Vance together.
I mean, they announced that they had obviously made those overtures over and over again, and we're still hopeful, but I don't know.
I really hope there's a debate. I think a debate is something that has the potential of turning the tide, but there do need to be some real policy questions asked on the things that he's riding on, right? I mentioned off air, you know, when Trump was asked the question, what do you do on day one? He said, well, first, I'll cut the interest rates, which he lacks the authority to do, and I will drill, baby, drill. And so he had a canned answer. He had something that's going to have a knee-jerk reaction from some people saying, yeah, well, interest rates are too high. That's why I can't afford a house. So he's going to fix that. I think there needs to be a little bit of holding his feet to the fire and saying, well, you don't actually have the authority to cut interest rates. And by the way, how are you going to make things less expensive with a 30% tariff on imports on things that aren't made here in the U.S. That are purchased by everyone? And isn't that going to cost more for you know, the middle class and people who are struggling? And I know that's a little bit wonky, but challenge him on his assertions that he's going to do these things to fix all the problems. Because you know, to be fair, there should be a greater exploration of, well, what are you going to do about the climate? Because you say now you're going to, you know, you're going to continue to allow fracking. What's your plan? I do think that a debate is something that is going to be closely watched by people who are truly interested. the people who are just reading the headlines on, oh, you know, it was train wreckalicious. They were probably never going to vote for Harris anyways. I'm, you know, who are influenced by, oh, well, Fox News says she's bad, so therefore I'm not going to vote for her, you know.
We keep wanting media to treat the candidates fairly and the same, and that's not going to happen. I think the Harris campaign has recognized that and used that to their advantage and started to introduce things like humor in some of their responses to Trump. And, you know, I, as just a regular citizen or even as an elected official, keep looking for media to hold Trump to the same standard. And that is not going to happen. It's simply not going to happen. He's lowered the bar so much, there is a different standard with respect to Trump all around. And I think this name calling and the continuous bashing that he does is a part of that. He's not going to be held to account. And even if there is a camp, a debate between the candidates, I think we're still going to see a difference in the way the candidates are spoken about afterwards, even if they both perform at their very best.
Yeah, that's probably true. Yep.
Trump is clickbait.
Yep.
And the major networks know it, and they don't care. They just want clicks.
Rick,
Not NPR.
Thank you, Judith. Rick says that I just want to get this out there. Denebash basically was repeating many of Trump's lies as if they were legitimate questions. It's bad journalism. Trump could make up a lie and then the mainstream, quote unquote, media decides to use those lies to try to trip up Harris, and it's just ugly. Let her stick to TikTok and Instagram. People are listening there. I understand the point of the letter. To me, however, the reason to ask the questions is because they're out there, they seem to be sticking, and you have an opportunity to clean them up.
It gave her a forum to speak to some of the issues he's raised.
To the issues.
Yeah.
Some yes, some no. I mean, to Heather's point. I mean, there were things that she wasn't answering directly. But there certainly were other things that she was. And so I do think I understand why you do that. I don't think it's like I don't think it's that Donald Trump is writing Denebash's questions. I do think that it is. These are some of the things that have stuck to the wall or the walls. And let's look and see what your response is to these. So that seems to me to make sense, but I understand. I obviously understand the point of the letter. One more, and then we'll take a break. We go to, you know what? Let's just wait. We have a lot of letters on the same subject. So let's just hold there, and we'll take a break. When we come back, we'll continue. We all have letters. We'll move on. And we welcome you, panel@wamc.org. First news with Rick Reff. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion for this Friday, the 30th of August. The roundtable will be off on Monday for the Labor Day holiday. We will return on Tuesday. We'll have all kinds of great special programming on Monday, but there will be no panel, and we will get back to it on Tuesday morning. And for those of you who are lucky enough to have the time off, I hope you enjoy it. Let me go to, we're talking, of course, about the interview last night with Kamala Harris, with Denebash on CNN, first major interview since Kamala Harris became the front runner and then the Democratic Party nominee. Larry writes and says, I can't understand how this can be picked apart so critically. It was an interview. Questions and answers. Have we gotten so accustomed to the bombastic entertainment value of Trump that he's become the standard for comparison? Someone normal shows up and every gesture is dissected. Although I will give you the concern over fracking, this may have been a way for the Harris campaign to eliminate one topic Trump can go crazy over in the Keystone State. All right. Thank you, Larry. Now we go to John. And our media, is our media learning? First they complain Kamala isn't doing interviews, and then when she does, they complain she's doing it wrong. Here's a clue. It's not about what the media wants. Well, I don't know necessarily.
I'm not saying she was doing it wrong by any means. I think she stayed the course, and she was quite conservative in the way that she handled the interview, as she probably had to be, because we wanted her to appear presidential. You know, she was not knocking any home runs out of the park, and she didn't, you know, fumble either. But it didn't really, I feel strongly that it didn't really move the dial either way. It just kind of kept things as they are. And that's probably all she needed to do right then.
She was,
I think she wanted to kind of be conservative and careful and maybe saving some stuff for future discussions. As an example, and in response to the prior letter writer who says we're overthinking this, well, that's what we do. when Dana Bash said I'm terrified. When Ms. Bash said she was surprised that the vice president has never personally met Donald Trump, what Harris could have said, well, I didn't meet him because he didn't attend the inauguration of Biden and Harris. That would have been an interesting little shot and reminding people how Trump did not support the peaceful transition of power. But she didn't go there, even though she knew that was the case.
John writes to us, Bob writes to us and says, listening to Judith bemoan Kamala's refusal to devastate her chances in Pennsylvania by coming out against fracking is so misguided. The worst thing that can happen for the struggle to combat global warming is for Trump to be elected. Whatever small endorphin rush Judith might get from Harris making a bold denunciation of fracking is hardly worth the chance that it might cost Kamala the election.
Judith, can I defend you here?
Please.
I just think that's ridiculous. I think that people who work in substantive policy areas with the knowledge need to talk about the science as they understand it, which is what I hear Judith doing and where she's coming from. And yes, we recognize that if she took a different position that was banning fracking, it would be a huge problem. But I don't think there's any problem. I don't think I disagree with the idea that people in the Democratic Party or who are very concerned about climate change should speak out to try to keep pushing Kamala Harris in the direction that we want.
Linda writes, one doesn't technically have to ban fracking to put some stringent stipulations on it.
Bingo.
Such that it is, in effect, banned. Then we go to Russ, who says, though Harris has shored up the Democratic fringe vote, she still needs to contest the largely white male middle of the road vote to achieve a majority. If she cannot find a headline policy to convince these folks that they will be better off under the presidency, her presidency, soon, her prospects look limited. I find that letter interesting. First of all, I know polls, and I get it. But, I mean, the message right now seems to be working, number one. Number two, this largely white male middle-of-the-road vote doesn't strike me, and please, panel, correct me, as on the fence.
No. But I also think it's not the majority. I mean, I think that's the mistake, right?
Yeah.
I think the mistake is assuming that it is the traditional white male vote that is going to decide the outcome of the election. And I don't think that's correct. I think it's actually, it's a lot more nuanced than that. There is a huge number of people who, whether they vote or not, will determine the outcome of the election. And are they going to be energized to get out and vote? So to my point, appealing to independents is really the key. It's not appealing to white males. It's appealing to people who are independent, who are tired of, you know, the sort of party bashing that's happening on each side. You know, not that some of it isn't completely deserved, but that can't be your campaign. You know, they stink, therefore you should elect me. I think, again, I said this earlier, but I think her real missed opportunity was having a concise list of three or four things that she could do. And I mean, if I was writing it, she'd you know, I would once and for all make bipartisan immigration reform a major priority, and I would make it happen. And she did kind of say that at some point during the interview. But to me, that's one of the big legacy issues that she's going to have to own, and she should have addressed it directly right out of the gate.
I think white male, middle-of-the-road voters may very well decide this election, but not by going to the polls, by staying home. So, you know, I experience talking to constituents in my day-to-day who are traditional Republicans. They, you know, are business-oriented people who care about how taxpayer dollars are funded or are spent. And they're not happy with Trump as a candidate. They don't want him. He's too inconsistent to be depended on. And he's too bombastic. And they don't like his, you know, plays for media, right? But they're not maybe comfortable with Harris. Maybe some of them will be convinced by her taking a more moderate position on some of these issues. But I think some of those people are just going to sit out the election, or they're going to come and they're going to vote down ballot candidates and they're going to skip the presidential line. And that could tilt the vote in favor of Harris. So I think that that vote is very important. I was interested to see in an article in the Times that was talking about, you know, how crass Trump is when his campaign was asked about whether or not he's alienating women. The campaign said women, and I think this speaks to everybody, deserve a president who will secure our nation's borders, remove violent criminals from our neighborhoods, and build an economy that helps our families thrive. And I thought to myself, both campaigns say that. That's the same set of priorities for both campaigns.
Yeah. So I want to nitpick just for a second.
Please
because
do.
Because you just said white male, a.k.a. business owners. And I have a couple, as the president of the business council, I will say this. Two out of three new small businesses are founded by women or minorities, A. Small business make up the vast majority of business in the country, although they do not employ the vast number of people. There's a little dichotomy there. But I think using business as a proxy for Republican white male values is a mistake. I think businesses have much more nuanced concerns. Being, you know, bristling at overregulation and the 8,000 gazillion forms you have to fill out and all the things you have to do to start a business in New York bothers small business owners every bit as much, if not more, than big business. And the last thing I'll say, and this is just obviously something that bothers me all the time, I hate using the word corporate as a proxy for everything that is bad. Corporate is it's a form of government. Nonprofits are corporations. It's just, to me, it's lazy and it's sort of red meat appeal to people who are unhappy and think that, you know, there's some white male corporate fat cat sitting back who's depriving them of everything that they're entitled to. It's not right. There's lots and lots of very, very good corporations out there, as there are lots and lots of very good, you know, independent small businesses and partnerships and all of those. And, you know, so I I've heard Harris say that, you know, inflation was caused by corporate greed. And I just think that is A, inaccurate. I mean, yes, there are probably businesses that took advantage of the supply chain issues, took advantage of shortages during the pandemic and all of that. But that is not what caused inflation. Inflation, and I'm, you know, I wish Aaron was here to talk about the infusion of cash into the economy when people had nothing to do but spend money, is it certainly a factor in that. And so anyway, so I got off on this huge tangent, but my point was just mainly that I can't stand business as a term being used as a proxy for something that it is not. It's much more diverse, much more nuanced in positions. But where there's agreement is we want the ability to operate, you know, in a way that allows us to be successful.
You know, Harris has spoken out about price gouging and kind of making that a plank in her platform. And, you know, economists basically do not support her perspective and her approach. Zephyr Teachout has a new article in The Atlantic that broke this week where she basically says, ignore the economists. You know, people on the ground know what's going on. We see it day to day. It was a very interesting take that basically, you know, economists and economic models function in these environments that are not necessarily realistic. And I think that's an important point.
Yeah, but if you look at the price of something and you think that the reason that the price is up is just because of price gouging, you're incorrect. The cost of raw materials has gone up. The cost of shipping has gone up. The cost of everything has gone up. And the shortages, I mean, it's supply and demand. When you have a shortage of something, what people are willing to pay for it goes up.
And not just in this country. And I think that's a really important point, that like inflation, you're now seeing it stabilize in other parts of the world as well. This was not an American phenomenon. So to say that it was Joe Biden's fault or Kamala Harris's fault is just not true.
Right.
Meanwhile, in Florida, Donald Trump was watching the debate. He was also actually attacking it before it even went on television, even before Vice President Kamala Harris's interview with CNN aired. Trump began attacking it. In the morning, he criticized her for having her running mate, Governor Tim Walz of Minnesota, on hand beside her. After seeing a clip of the interview, he criticized her for rambling incoherently, and about half an hour before the interview was broadcast, he told a crowd in Wisconsin that the setting, a table for four at a restaurant in Savannah, made her look unpresidential.
I don't agree.
It's a table and chairs. I don't know how. Well, anyway. This, of course, was more, she said, she was sitting behind that desk, this massive desk, and she didn't look like a leader today, Mr. Trump said at a town hall. I'll be honest, I don't see her negotiating with President Xi of China. I don't see her with Kim Jong-un like we did. So we're going to have to see what happens.
That's code and a dog whistle for women and women of color cannot be presidential. That's what I heard when I heard that clip.
After the interview concluded, the usual loquacious Mr. Trump reduced his take to a single word on Truth Social, his social media platform, saying, boring.
We like boring.
Mr. Trump and his campaign have spent 3 weeks criticizing Ms. Harris for not holding a news conference with reporters or sitting down for a major interview. After she became the Democratic nominee, Mr. Trump held two news conferences aimed at taunting Ms. Harris and showing his willingness to address the media. Last week, he granted a number of interviews to mainstream media outlets. But after Ms. Harris agreed to an interview with Dana Bash on CNN, Mr. Trump began criticizing her almost immediately. Judith.
Well, I think it's clear that Trump is unraveling in real time. And the most important thing is for the media to just very fairly cover everything he says. And I think the contrast will not be greater. This former president it's not like he was a model of stability when he was president, but I think he's gotten worse. Most people don't see what he posts on Truth Social, so that really should be shared more widely. And, it's a really frightening thing to see how he's reacting to having a serious candidate run against him. This is really foreshadowing an absolutely horrific administration if he should run. I think the most important thing for Harris and Walz is to keep campaigning the way they have been campaigning. Pundits will say, oh, crowd size doesn't mean anything, but there sure is a lot of enthusiasm out there. And it's not just people showing up at rallies. It's people that are knocking on doors and making phone calls and writing endless postcards. But I think the real issue that needs scrutiny is how the Trump campaign is planning election interference, how they are working to disenfranchise voters. And I was happy to see that a Democrat adjacent organization was formed with $10 million to make sure that the election is not stolen. Because I think the Trump folks know that they're not going to have more votes on Election Day. So they have pivoted to disenfranchising voters and doing everything they can to block Harris from taking office, just like they tried with Biden. But and thankfully, narrowly, Biden won. But this time, it's much more well-organized. It's much more funded. You know, the Republicans have lots and lots of lawyers working to make sure that Harris doesn't win. And that, I think, that's kind of the shadow campaign that's going on right now, and we should pay attention to it.
So can I, on the Truth Social point, you know, sort of, and crowd size, let's talk about crowd size for a minute. You know, Trump suggested that the rallies, the Harris rallies were, you know, AI-generated crowd size. Mm-hmm. At the same, like within the same week that he's posting images of
Taylor Swift,
Swifties for Trump people, which are I think blatantly AI generated, and so when he's asked about it, he's like, "Oh, I know, you know, they post, you know, AI generated things about me all the time," and it's sort of like such a weird deflection. Like, you're not going to get in trouble for falsifying. You're complaining about AI generated imagery,
and then using it.
And then when asked about it, making yourself like a victim of it, it's like dealing with, you know, an irrational teenager sometimes.
But it is a distraction from what Judith is talking about, which is that we have these efforts, particularly, you know, Georgia being a perfect example, to insert, you know, Trump loyalist elections inspectors and folks in districts to count ballots. And it's really scary. And I don't think we're going to see people like Raffensperger, the Secretary of State from Georgia, or even Mike Pence really speak out about how outrageous this is. Those are two Republicans who have suffered the consequences, because people's lives are at risk if they oppose this MAGA environment. And we have this underground effort. It's like, oh, yeah, let's fight about AI images. But at the end of the day, what's really happening is boots on the ground in places like Georgia, where outrageous decisions are being made that could hold up the election.
I thought one of the moments of the interview last night that was poignant was when she was describing the phone call between her and President Biden, when the president called her and told her that he had decided to drop out of the race. And she said, the first thing she said is, "Are you sure?"
Mm-hmm.
And to me, and maybe I'm reading too much into it, but it to me, that just said a lot about their relationship and a lot about just I think by all accounts, I haven't really heard much on the other side that, you know, during this whole time where Biden was deciding and there was a lot of pressure, and there's new reporting over the last couple of days of senior Democrats really
she supported him
going
she
full,
continued to support him
full court press that she wanted out of that. She wanted out. She did not want to make it look like she was pushing him out at all. And while her team was certainly gearing up for that possibility, there was also just a very much her decision that this was not going to be something that she was going to have anything to do with.
If she had aggressively called for him to step out, she would be falling into the angry black woman trope, and it would be very, very hard, I think, for her to solidify support behind her. I also think that her supporting Biden speaks to her own record, and you hear a lot of commentators today talking about her answer to the question on Bidenomics, where she said, you know, that was good work that we have done, but there's more to do.
do. And I think that's the right answer, because if she starts criticizing her own record, she's going to be biting her own tail, and it's going to be very dangerous.
It just emphasizes the contrast. I mean, she has grace. She has the ability to have grace and show respect in a way that, you know, certainly Trump, I don't think has, I don't think anyone would argue like that he is a gracious or respectful person, but that matters to people.
Yes. Judith?
Yeah. And she actually seems to like people and likes her family, and her family likes her. And whenever Trump criticizes her for her laugh, which seems to have slowed down a little bit, it makes me think we've never heard Donald Trump laugh, and we rarely have seen him smile. So I think she's just kind of bringing the humanity back to the presidency if she is fortunate enough to win.
Yeah, and you see that with Walls too. I mean, there's a I mean, we get into this whole thing about the joy, but there certainly is a levity that comes from the campaign that well, we're not used to.
I'm ordering the hats. Make America joyful again. They'll be green or purple.
There you go.
Maja.
All right. Well, we'll take a break. When we come back, we'll continue. We'll move on to a couple of other topics and finish up for this Friday edition of the Roundtable. Judith Eng, Heather Mulligan, and March Gallagher are here. We welcome your letters, panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. We'll be back right after this break. Good morning. Welcome back to the Roundtable and to our discussion this morning. And we have Judith Eng, Heather Mulligan, and March Gallagher with us. We welcome you, panel at WAMC.org. And we have about 15 minutes or so to wrap up for this Friday edition of the panel. I do want to get to letters. We have many just sort of all over the board, but mostly having to do with either the interview itself or the issue of fracking. Amy says, well, I do think policy specifics are important. I wonder how many people want to dive into the nuance of policy positions. If specifics were important to the American people, Trump wouldn't be tied in the polls. People would see that Biden economy is largely thriving, and we wouldn't be so focused on vibes. People want to know the what. Many folks are too simple-minded for or don't care about the how.
It's about a feeling. You know what I mean? Unfortunately, yeah, that's what's driving us to do what we do. It's about a feeling, and that, you know, we didn't have that feeling for Joe Biden, even though he had done great work. And I think we'll look back on his presidency and be surprised at how many amazing things happen because they're just not being called out. But Trump is generating a feeling, and now you have Harris generating a feeling. So it's about something else. It's not about the policy.
We may not all be up on the issues, but that doesn't mean there's a simple-mindedness to it.
No, but I do think, I mean, there are two big weaknesses that are front and center for a lot of people. And one is the immigration crisis. And certainly even in New York, we felt the consequence of the border not being secure. And now, sure, there was a lot of political game playing with governors from other states and all that stuff. But there's no denying that that was a problem that became worse during the Biden administration. And then inflation. And inflation is hard because, you know, there's no questioning that a bag of chips at the grocery store costs more than it did. And inflation at 2% still means they're still going to cost more, you know. So those are the things that people see in front of them. And so while, you know, unemployment is low and wages have gone up and all of those things, there's still something people can point to as saying, I can't believe how much my grocery bill is. And there needs to be an answer for that.
Well, you know, it's in this case, I would say, rather than saying it's the economy stupid, it's the inequity stupid. You know what I'm saying? Like, the economy's good, but we still have some people getting too much. And when I say some people need to have less, or, you know, as it's phrased on the left, tax the rich, I'm not talking about people who golf at your local golf club, okay? I'm talking about billionaires and the top rates. And we may disagree on this, but I do think there needs to be substantive change there. And Kamala Harris has proposed this, you know, increased tax rate on capital gains, and it hasn't really gotten the traction or conversation that you might expect people to be talking about when it's a real policy issue. But it is the inequity. So we can say the economy is doing well by all the measures that we usually use, but people still feel the strain that they're not getting enough. And housing prices and the cost of housing is a perfect example of that.
Yeah, no, I don't disagree with that. And I will say, you know, without stating any like complexity of position on this, virtually everyone will agree to raising taxes if it's someone else.
Exactly. And there's not that many billionaires. So I think, you know, they don't have, you know, there's not that many of them. So we should gang up on them and increase their tax rates.
Well, just to push back a little bit on the letter writer. You know, there's not a lot of spirited debate on issues in America today. That doesn't mean there shouldn't be. And to quote the old Journey song, this has to be more than a feeling. You know, there are some pretty major issues facing our nation. And if you want to just point to economic self-interest, what is the future of Social Security? Why isn't the Biden student loan forgiveness program able to take effect as the courts keep blocking it? Housing, health care. Why isn't health care a basic right? Why do people who don't have enough resources don't get the same quality health care as people who do have resources? These are pretty significant issues that that need to be discussed in the context of not only a presidential race, but congressional races, state legislative races. I don't think we just have to go along and say it's all about the vibe. The vibe is quite important, but policy positions, you know, should be debated before people vote.
All right, let's go to a few more letters on this. Kevin says, thank you, Judith, for mentioning Trump's lack of laughter. I have never seen him laugh. What is wrong about a laugh that comes from joy or happiness? Trump is a miserable, repulsive, and disgusting monster. That's coming from someone with joy. And lacks that joy of laughter. Then we go to this letter from Patrick regarding Heather's tangent about corporate greed and price gouging. Although not all businesses are guilty of these practices, corporate greed and price gouging are prevalent realities. Maybe Judith has some thoughts about the fossil fuel industry and strategies, or the panel could consider Trump Incorporated history. Please recognize that not all entities with bottom line priorities are beneficial to the consumer.
Not all of them are bad either.
I just want to agree with that. You know, I think we get into this mode where profit is a negative. And you know, I see this in my community all the time. People do not think projects should earn a profit. And this is a problem. People are not going to take on these projects. People are not going to develop the housing we need if there is not some, you know, return for the pain of going through the project. So we're in a place where we criticize profit and the profit motive. And I understand why that is. And I'm just going to go back to my statement from before. It's the inequity stupid. That's why we're criticizing profit.
I mean, the profit motive is what drives efficiency. It is what drives there are other, I'm not saying that there's not some negatives to it also, but if you take away the profit motive, you lose a lot of the innovation that we've experienced. You lose a lot of efforts in trying to make things more efficient. I mean, absent, and I know, you know, people were very concerned 10 years ago about automation. automation was in part driven by a profit motive. And thank goodness we have it, because we have such a workforce shortage right now that if we did not have it, our GDP would have dropped. And that impacts the quality of life of everyone, not just the lower echelons. It's important to recognize that what profit motive is, at least to some extent, is about creation of value.
Well, since I'm here, obviously outing myself as a capitalist, let me just also say I believe in a very well-regulated capitalism. And unless we have strong regulation putting limits on these things, it's not going to be successful to help all people. So that's the other side of the coin.
And it definitely doesn't work in the healthcare sector. We have for-profit health insurance companies, and it's not efficient. It's often not humane. And the bigger problem, since we're having an economics class here, is what do you do with fossil fuel companies who exist to have a return on investment for their shareholders and are profit-focused, and their product is causing climate change, which they don't have any responsibility for the externalities. Exxon and Shell doesn't pay when Ulster County has major floods. They don't pay when there's an increase of hospitalizations due to heat stroke or asthma.
Asthma, right.
There's just like, there's no connection there. It can't just be raw profit. And I think, you know, a clear example is the tobacco industry. Smoking is down in the United States, but it is not down worldwide. So they have a product that kills people. They're making a lot of money, and the regulation is not working. So, you know, what do you do with quality of life issues like that when the profit motive is not serving the public interest?
Well, getting the money out of politics sure would help.
Well, and I actually think, you know, if you look at some of the fossil fuel companies that you mentioned, some of them are the largest investors in renewable energy in the
not
U.S.
Really. Not Exxon, not Shell, not BP.
Well, I will just beg to differ. I know that there's been massive investment by all three of the companies that you mentioned because they're trying desperately to transition to what the writing on the wall is. And, you know, as far as you talked about tobacco, I mean, if you looked at some of the traditional tobacco companies in the United States, the vast majority of them spun off their tobacco industries because of the liability, because of the negative imagery. And in retail companies, they do not want to be branded with being responsible for these things. So you do see them run for the hills sometimes when there's a realization that a product is a problem.
I'm going to bring it back to this presidential race right now and just say, you know, not all regulation is bad. And I think one candidate is much more likely to bring appropriate regulatory policy to, you know, corporate America and environmental. And that's Kamala Harris. It's definitely not the Trump administration. So,
agree. I don't disagree with that at all.
But not all regulation is bad. You know, we do see a lot of red tape and things could be very challenging to get done. At the same time, we should be supporting that regulatory authority that does make a difference.
I don't disagree with that. I mean, I think regulation is extremely important. It has to be rational, and the people developing the regulations should be experts, not necessarily legislators. And you know, it's a problem when people who don't have the underlying knowledge of how things work on the ground start deciding that they're going to be engaged in the practice of writing the regulations themselves.
You know, one thing,
but
I've
unfortunately,
been...
the Chevron decision out of the Supreme right. Court takes responsibility away from regulators.
At the federal level,
and I think, you know, I think Exhibit A these days for the need for strong, robust, but efficient regulations is the listeria outbreak with Boar's Head cold cuts. I mean, if we didn't need a reminder about the need for food safety regulations and more inspections and more oversight, you know, it shouldn't be that risky to get a bologna sandwich in America today, but it is.
Agreed. can't have a moment of space. So
I'm just trying to think of where we look at. We have about a minute left, and I don't want to go any further. But I'm thinking about as we look at these issues and we think of the going back and forth, we're bringing it to a level that I don't think we're going to see at the debate, right? I mean, we're not going to bring this. This is not going to reach this any further.
Regulating right? food safety will not be discussed at the debate.
Right. Oh, boar's head. Okay.
Yeah.
I don't think it will.
Bologna
I mean,
sandwich example.
Exactly.
It won't come up in the debate because, you know, Trump doesn't have a lot to offer. So he's going to try stunts. You know, remember in the Hillary debate when he had
all of the women right.
in the audience
yes.
who Bill Clinton may or may
yes.
not have had affairs with. I mean, he's going to have, he's so freaked out now, he's going to have a whole bunch of stunts up his sleeve, and Harris will be calm. She will focus on the issues, and it puts a lot of pressure on the moderators.
Yeah. I think, I mean, if let's just hypothetically say that Trump was for some reason asked about bologna sandwiches. I mean, I think what he would say, and it's a complete deflection, is, well, they should be held responsible, right? It's not about, he would never address like, oh, well, our regulatory climate is too loose yeah. or there weren't enough inspections or any of those things. He would just say, well, yeah, they should be responsible if they put something out there that, you know, was, and
I don't know if he would say that. I think he's the Listeria caucus of the Republican.
I doubt that.
We're out of time, and it seems like it's just in time. So
yeah.
My thanks to everybody this morning. Have a beautiful holiday weekend. We'll be right back.